This is Positive Parenting. Parenting expertise and advice from best-selling parenting author and national newspaper columnist, Mr. Dad, Armin Brott.
Hey there, welcome to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. Somewhere, at some point, a change occurred in society. Some people call it a perversion. What it was is that youth athletics became professionalized. It became trophies over toughness, product over process, talent over tenacity, and winning over development. The death of backyard basketball and the slow fade of true open gyms gave way to structure and organization and over-parented involvement. This professionalization has created an environment of externally driven, perfectionist, and stressed competitors. Parenting athletes also requires a vast amount of sacrifice, both emotionally and physically. So here's the big question. Are we doing it correctly? A lot of people would say no, and all you got to do is take a look at the focus, which seems to be more on what's in it for me than it is on the skills and life lessons that sports can teach. We seem to have miniaturized long-term growth and development and maximized a short-term focus on winning or losing. In this part of today's show, we're going to be talking about the problems in sports, but we're going to be focusing mostly on building kids' mental toughness because that's what they're really going to need to succeed more than just this focus on, hey, don't mess up. Learning mental toughness is a skill that's going to transfer into real life and go far beyond their playing days.
Did you just look down at your phone? You did it again, didn't you? You know, you're flying down the road in a 3-ton hunk of steel, and a text takes your eyes off the road for an average of 5 seconds. At 55 miles per hour, that's long enough to travel the length of a football field and cause some serious damage. Turn it off. Trust me. Whatever it is, you'll live.
Learn more at StopTextStopWrecks.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guest for this part of today's show is Dr. Rob Bell, who's the co-author of a book called Don't Should on Your Kids, Build Their Mental Toughness. Rob, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So what do you mean by should in there? Shoulds in quotes.
Sure. Well, again, we titled Don't Should on Your Kids. It really seems to be a positive thing that we hear. Like, you know, you should practice more. You should do this. And really what we're doing, though, as parents a lot of times is we're just taking an adult viewpoint and we're imposing that on our kids. And in doing so, we don't allow them to build their own passion. And when we should on them all the time, it seems positive. But, you know, we're really, you know, we're just imposing our viewpoint on our kids.
Now, the book overall is about sports and sports parenting. Are you talking about in particular having to do with sports or just generally speaking, don't should on your kids?
Well, a lot of times, I mean, it can be transferred, I think, to anything. You know, the reason why we wrote this, obviously, for parents is what we see is that a lot of kids that are good at what they do, but they really just don't love it. And a lot of that, what comes from is really them just not pursuing their own passion. And, you know, it can be well-meaning that, you know, you should be a vice president. Well, you should go here to college. You should join this fraternity. And all the time, it just doesn't allow that individual to pursue their own goals and their own passion. I think that's the beauty about what sport can provide is that's the time to explore, to try out different sports and to fail and to learn how to fail.
Well, that's what you talk about a lot in the book is exactly the problem there, which is that we're not giving the kids a chance to fail. They're kind of all these things that are coming together is the desire to protect them, the desire to, at the same time, to protect the investment. I mean, we put a lot of time and a lot of money and a lot of effort into schlepping kids to soccer games and soccer practices and then having them try out or practice skills with them, and you want some sort of a return on that investment.
You know, I think that's spot on, and I think that's why that pressure really gets pushed on to the kids. So we have a lot of externally driven, perfectionistic, athletes. And with the parenting piece, I mean, they make an extreme amount of sacrifice, you know, both financially and emotionally. And it's the main difference, though, between being a parent and being a coach. And those lines really just get blurred.
Well, how do you try to determine the area there? Because I keep thinking it's sort of all black and white, but it's not really black and white. There's huge amounts of gray in there between, you know, a child who could be pushed a little bit, who's maybe a little bit, you know, not willing to put in some work. I mean, somebody's got some potential, or pushing too hard.
And it's true. I think there's definitely, I think you spot on, there's a lot of gray area with it. And one of the things we address in the book is to be able to have that conversation, you know, with the kid. Is this something that they want to do? What are their goals? And so they're not being should on, but they're actually, you know, being able to verbalize, this is what I want. And in return, what the parents can do is then the parents can hold them accountable. So, for example, if there's a kid that really wanted to win a state championship and that was the goal, and, you know, with the coach, here are the things that you have to do. And, you know, once that really gets verbalized, if that's something that they really want to do, then parents have that right to hold them accountable. And one of the things we really address in the book is that effort is everything. And to be able to put forth 100% effort in all we do is very, very difficult. But that's the skill that builds that mental toughness, and that's a skill that's going to last way beyond when sport is going to be over.
Now, do you think that the role of the parent is more important than the role of the coach? Because I could see that they could be conflicting at various points, and it could go either way. I mean, the parent could be somebody who, in a way, wants the kid to relive his or her not realized sports dreams. You know, so there's all this pressure to succeed or to be a big star, and the coach may be talking about teamwork more and not emphasizing stardom. Or you could have it the other way around, where you've got a parent who's talking about, look, you got to be a good member of a team, you got to pass the ball, you got to do things to help the overall organization advance, and you got the coaches who are pushing for that championship. So which one wins out?
Sure, that's a good point. The reason why we wrote this book was because, you know, we've worked with coaches and athletes and teams for over 15 years, and the one piece we missed was the parents, and that's the part I'm a little bit embarrassed about. But parents are the ones that are with them longer than what the coaches are. So even though the coaches make a vast amount of sacrifice, and I think coaches are the most important people in society today, because I think everybody needs a coach. But when the parents, you know, say if a parent is coaching from the sideline and they're hearing something different from the coach, the one thing that we do know is that kids want to do everything they can to please the coach and to please the parent. And so it really just becomes a game that gets pushed on to the kid on who are they going to please. And, well, you know, one of the things we discuss in the book is, you know, parents being able to cheer from the sideline and not coach from the sideline. And that's a big part of where, again, these lines get blurred, and that big difference between being a parent and then being a coach.
Well, yeah, you got to go home and make breakfast for that person the next morning and that kind of thing. It's going to be a different sort of relationship, right?
Yeah. Right, exactly.
So you talk a lot in the book about mental toughness, and that's really the emphasis of the book is not so much about the ins and outs of the parenting part of it, but to teaching the kids to be resilient. And you very intriguingly start off this chapter on mental health or mental toughness, debunking this whole idea that we've all heard so much about how sports are 90% mental, 10% physical. I've always wondered about that. It just seems like if you haven't got the physical part, no amount of metal is going to help you. But talk about that in a little bit. You seem like you're kind of on that same track as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one thing I say in the book is that, you know, that's what we've heard throughout our life, is that sports is 90% mental, and I just think that's a canard, that's a lie. You know, sports is 90% physical. When we ever watch sports, we are watching something that's physical. Whenever we practice, we're practicing physical movements. But it's that last 10%, that's the mental part. So if an athlete has the 90% but doesn't have the other 10%, it really doesn't matter. So that last 10%, that's the mental toughness, and that's what we call it that hinge. That's what's going to unlock the other 90%. And if an athlete that, you know, is pretty good physically but, you know, has that last 10%, that's the athlete that's going to be mentally tough, and that's the athlete that's going to play their best when it matters the most.
So what is mental toughness? Define that for us.
Sure, absolutely. Well, mental toughness is is one, again, being able to play your best when it matters the most. That's a big part. So playing well under pressure. And then the other part of that mental toughness is how do we deal, how do we cope, and how do we handle the struggle and the adversity that's going to happen. The beauty about sports is that this is going to happen. This isn't an if. This is just a when. And, boy, that's why I think athletics is just such a great realm to teach these lessons and allow an individual to build that mental toughness because, and again, that's what's going to transfer into life. That's a skill that's going to last way beyond when sport is over. So are we really working on mental toughness? And the thing is like sport teaches whatever we want it to teach. If we focus on athletes, you know, being good communicators, having that leadership skills, being competitors and being mentally tough, that's what we're going to get out of it. If all we stress are winnings, rankings, and championships, then that's what they're going to get out of it.
So do you think that there's a place there for kids who are not terribly adept physically?
Well, I do. And that's the beauty about sports is I don't think anybody should ever go without playing. I mean the amount of benefits that we can get. I mean just physical activity, you know, the fun that we can get out of it, I think is incredible. The one part is that when we stress this in the book as well is to have that unstructured, unsupervised play where individuals play in the backyard and we come up with different games and play and be able to have that movement. All part of that, I think it's involved with, you know, with mental toughness, with sport, with communication, and the biggest part is just that play.
Now, how do you help, how do you help parents who may not be the most mentally tough people, that they may be boxed into a particular way of looking at sports or life in general, change their attitude so that they can teach their kids? Because as we were talking about before, I mean, the parents are probably more dominant in the way that the worldview is going to be developed than a coach. And, you know, a lot of parents come in with the wrong attitude.
Well, it is. I mean, I'd be remiss if I said, you know, not to buy the book. I definitely think that helps. but it's true. I mean, a parent that, and again, this the brain is a muscle, though. You know, any skill that we want to work on, if we put ourselves in these situations, we can get better at it if we're learning the lessons from it. And that's the beauty about it is I think it's a skill that we can always improve upon. And it's not that we're born with it. We just increase it if we work on it.
Talking with Rob Bell, who's the co-author of Don't Should on Your Kids, Build Their Mental Toughness. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll keep talking to Rob.
Okay, forest animals. Kids are coming to the forest, and it's up to us to make their visit a good one. Sparrow, have you practiced the most popular bird songs for the year?
Of course.
Catchy. I like it. River, how's the temperature?
It's a refreshing 52 degrees, man.
I love it. Turtle.
He's not here yet, man.
He's late every morning. Okay. Squirrel.
The forest has been preparing just for you. To learn more about cool things to do in the forest, visit discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Broad. If you're just joining us, talking with Rob Bell, who's the co-author with Bill Parisi of Don't Should on Your Kids, Build Their Mental Toughness. So we've been talking about mental toughness so far, but I want to get into some of the other many factors that you talk about in the book about, for example, what goes on in the preseason, what goes on in the pregame. Tell us a little bit about how a team should be set up from the very beginning.
Sure. We address the book in a fashion that goes through the whole season. So we have the preseason, we have the pregame, we have the in-game. So these are the things that parents should focus on during the game. And that's what really gets a lot of attention. And then even after the game and after the season, we want to structure it like that because each little bit, like in the preseason, is all about, you know, motivation and setting goals and having that determination. You know, after the game isn't really the time that we want to be talking about that stuff. We want to be talking about, you know, hey, what did you learn? Did you have fun? And are you enjoying playing? And so that's the way we want to structure that, really, is throughout the entire season. There are a lot of different focuses that that parents and athletes need to take, and timing is everything.
Timing in what way?
Well, for example, like in the preseason, you know, that's the time that we really want to address like one's motivation and why do they want to play. Even in the off season, and that's the thing that's happened, is there's really not an off season anymore. Off season as well, that's the time where there's got to be a lot of give and take in terms of, you know, one's commitment, one's motivation. And then, you know, that's not the time really to address, you know, one's confidence. But before a game, you know, pregame, that's the time that parents can really enhance or kill their kids' confidence. Or that's the time that they can really enhance that they're excited rather than being nervous. I can't tell you how many times that parents can just ask their kids, hey, aren't you nervous? And, well, no, they weren't until you start asking them about it. And that's just one of the lessons there in the book.
Right. Well, it gives them an idea. Well, if they're thinking I should be nervous, maybe there's something to be nervous about. And yeah,
that's right. That's right. And we talk about, like, don't build it up. Don't make it any bigger than what it is.
Well, let's talk about one of the things. I think it's we talked about this just real briefly before, about the idea of when to push a kid who has some talent but maybe isn't doing it. But what about if you've got a kid who just isn't into it anymore? Do you let the kid quit or do you not let the kid quit? And then how, if you decide that there really is something there, how do you encourage this child to stick with it?
Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons. I think that's what really hits parents a lot, is because now that the stakes have really increased so much, they don't want their kid to drop out at age 8, and that means that they can't pick it back up when they're 13 and then play, because now everyone has gotten better and has gotten past them. The part around your first part, you know, we have to allow them to quit. I don't ever want it, but if they don't want to play, that's the part where they have to have ownership in what they want to do. And, you know, a lot of the times, you know, it's that, you know, once they get away from it and they find out, hey, you know, I really miss that, and allowing them to come back. Now, again, I think there's a good time to do it, not a good time. One of the rules that we put, like, in the book is that once they commit to the season, they're committed to the season. But it's after the season, always having that conversation, is this something that they want to do? Because what we see is, I mean, so many kids with, even with a little bit of talent, are playing on 5, 6, 7 different teams, traveling all year long, spending, you know, tons of money, and they can get burnt out really quick just because of the amount of stress that it takes, not only on the body but on the mind, to go through all that competition and to really not have any downtime from it.
And how do you talk to kids? I guess, you know, one of the things that you hear so much about, and I've heard from different people different sorts of ideas about this particular thing, but like, how do you talk to a kid about what happened during a game? Something went particularly well or something went particularly wrong? I mean, you don't want to just let it sit there without saying anything, but you don't want to say, boy, you really screwed that up.
That's right. We talk, again, like, timing is everything. So one of the things that we discuss in the book is the car ride home. And the reason why is because I've seen the car ride home ruin more relationships between parents and kids than anything else. And one of the rules that we put is that we can talk about anything on the car ride home except the game or the practice. And the reason why is because the kids are going to remember how you made them feel as a parent. And really nothing good ever happens out of that car ride home. There's not a good interaction, and the parent is just shooting on them the whole ride home. It's like a coffin for the kids. They can't escape. They can't breathe. And then they start dreading the car ride home. And one of the things we talk about is talk about anything except the game or the practice on the car ride home. Set up a time at, you know, at dinner or at home when everyone is cool, calm, and collected. The conversation is going to be so much more beneficial, and we're going to get more out of that. And that's really just one of the big rules that we discuss, is we've just seen it too often, is, you know, right after the game is not the time to talk about, you know, somebody missing a shot or why they didn't play well. I've worked with so many different athletes, and I've never had an athlete, never yet, have they told me, you know, I struck out on purpose, or, you know, I missed that shot on purpose. I mean, they're trying. But once we start challenging, you know, are you really trying out there? That's when the relationships and sport stops being fun.
And so when it hits there, though, is there a way to salvage that, to rescue it? If you've made a mistake as a parent and you accidentally said, God, it was so frustrating. I mean,
It is. Again, big part of that is the communication between the parents and the children. You know, when and what kind of strategy are we going to approach for this season? And we are going to mess up. That's the part is it's not about the setback. It's about the comeback, even with parenting. You know, even if we have messed up, can we own that and just get better? That's the whole job. That's the whole point, is just try and get 1% better each and every day.
Now, in the book you talk about you can communicate too much. What do you mean by that?
Right. Well, there's this coach from Illinois, John Gross, and he always said this. He said, you can't communicate too much with your team. And I totally agree with it. I think it was great. But one of the things that I see is from parents or dads or moms coaching from the sidelines, coaching, and they just hear it too often. And, again, the kid can't decipher, well, who to listen to. It can be a packed arena, 5,000 people. And if you have that kid's dad cheering, I can guarantee you they're going to be a signal out that voice. And if that's the voice that they're always hearing, again, we can communicate too much. There's a good time to communicate, not a good time. During the game and right after the game, just not good times.
You know, that's such a difficult thing. I mean, maybe I can't imagine I'm the only one, actually. You know, I sit at home, I watch a football game, and I'm screaming at people. You know, somebody who happens to be 3,000 miles away, playing football, and I'm yelling at him to shoot the thing already or throw it, for goodness,
right.
Whatever it is. And it seems like that stuff kind of just pops out of your mouth without really thinking about it. I mean, obviously it makes no sense. I can't imagine Aaron Rodgers is going to be listening to anything I have to say, even if I were right there. But, so you say these things. How do you restrain yourself as a parent from jumping up and shouting something out like that? Or do you just not go?
That's a great point, and that's why we talk about it in the book. We call it the lion's den, because that's exactly what it is. The lions can be quiet. And the lion's den is where all the parents congregate for the game. And it's once one thing happens, there's a bad call, somebody messes up, or they get behind, and all the lions start waking up, and then all it takes is one thing, and then everyone is cheering, and then there's just so much emotion and energy to it that the only way to combat it is going in to cheer, going into practice or games. We have to have a plan. We've got to have a plan about, how much are we going to cheer. And kids talk about it all the time. They just don't want their parents cheering for them. They want them cheering for the team and then other players in general. So there's a novel idea, is can we even go to the game and not cheer for our own kid, but cheer for the team and cheer for everybody else except for our own kid? That gets a bigger message across.
Well, what do you think about cheering for the other team if they do something particularly well?
Well, again, I mean, that sport is my entire life, so it's when I wake up, it's the one thing that I'm always fascinated about. And, if I'm going to be watching the Super Bowl, I'm really not going to cheer for the other team that I'm rooting against. But if they make a great play, I'll tell you what, that's part of watching it.
Right.
And I think that's perfectly acceptable. I see it all the time. And one of the things we discuss in the book is what true success is. And true success is being able to root for everybody.
Right.
When we can root for everybody, what that means is that we're comfortable in what we're trying to do and comfortable in our own success. That, this isn't a zero-sum game, that we can all be winners in one way or another.
Right. No, I mean, because I, for example, like to watch some football games for two different teams that I don't really have any particular stake in one way or the other. And just, it's much more fun to watch a competitive game where there's good plays going on both sides rather than some horrible blowout where somebody's 50 points ahead. It's just boring to watch that stuff. I'd much rather root for somebody or at least not maybe root for, but just say, hey, nice play for one team and, hey, nice play for the other team.
Oh, indeed. And those are the best. I think you nailed it, because those are the best type of matches. Those are the best type of games when you have two competitors playing at their best. That's what we want.
Dr. Rob Bell is the co-author with Bill Parisi of Don't Should on Your Kids, Build Their Mental Toughness. Rob, thanks very much. Do you have a website for the book?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, my website is drrobbell.com, and my Twitter is Dr. Rob Bell as well. And thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you.
I'm in almost every school bus and classroom. You see me around the neighborhood, and you tell me that I'm a pretty good kid.
Well, I'm one out of every five children in America, and I'm struggling with hunger.
Please, visit feedingamerica.org today and find your local food bank for ways to help.
Every dollar you donate helps provide 8 meals for kids like me.
We are Feeding America, brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Hey there, welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. It's time for a Parents at Play segment. You know, it's a brand new year, and if one of your resolutions is to spend more time having fun with your family, or if it isn't, you really need to reevaluate your priorities, these great family games are going to keep you on track and laughing. Lift It Deluxe from USAopoly. From the Parents at Play Department of New Twists comes, well, a new twist on the recreate the structure on the card games that we love so much. The object of the game is pretty basic, but what makes Lift It especially fun is that you need to get your head in the game, literally. Instead of using your hands to build what's on the card, you use a crane that's strapped to your head to pick up, move, and stack the various building components within the allotted time. You can play by yourself, one-on-one, or team against team. Lift It is challenging, frustrating, but in a fun way, and a delight to play. It takes about 30 minutes. It's for 1 to 8 players ages 8 and up. You can find out more at usaopoly.com. Pictopia Star Wars Edition from Wonderforge. You think you know your Star Wars trivia? Well, now's the time to show us what you've got. As with most games, there are rules to follow, tokens to move, and goals to accomplish, and we have no doubt that plenty of families will play this game exactly as intended. But we're also betting that just as many are going to skip the official game and spend their time looking through the 200 trivia-packed cards. Each card has 4 pictures on one side and 5 questions on the other. For example, on one card you find pictures of a Jedi Interceptor, an X-Wing Starfighter, an ARC-170 Starfighter, and a Y-Wing Starfighter. Here are the questions. Which one of these does the Gold Squadron fly in the Battle of Yavin? Which 2 take part in the Battle of Endor? Which 3 operate with fewer than 3 pilots? Which 1 is typically piloted by clone troopers? If you're a true Star Wars fan, and who isn't these days, you may not be able to survive without this game. But whether you're a Padawan or a Jedi Master, you'll love it. It's for 2 to 6 players ages 7 and up. You can find out more at wonderforge.com. Roaring River from Wonderforge. Based on the movie The Good Dinosaur, this game is a cooperative effort, meaning that the players either win or lose together. The object is to help Arlo, Spot, and their friends outrun the flooding river and get safely home. Players spin a spinner or play tokens, and they build a path from the waterfall to the mountain range. It's a fun, easy game that's perfect for 2 to 4 players ages 4 and up. More at wonderforge.com. Snoopy Flying Ace Game from Wonderforge. This one's based on the new Peanuts movie, but you don't have to have seen the film to enjoy the game. You'll need about 3 minutes to set the game up. The most complicated part is the Eiffel Tower and the spinning arm that balances atop it. Snoopy is on one side of the arm and his arch nemesis, the Red Baron, is on the other. One player spins the arm, and while the Beagle and his foe battle it out, players flip over the cards, each with a picture of one of the main Peanuts characters, and try to match one of theirs with one from another player before the spinning stops. It's for 2 to 4 Peanuts fans, or soon-to-be fans, ages 4 and up. You can find out more, again, at wonderforge.com. Wonky from USAopoly. In this game, the object is to build towers out of colored blocks. The cards tell you which size and which color to add to the tower. Now, that would be challenge enough with actual cubes, but the blocks here are a little out of whack, hence the name of the game, Wonky, which adds an element of hilarity, really and truly. A blast for 2 or more players ages 8 and up. USAopoly.com for more. We'll be back next week with another Parents at Play column or an Ask Mr. Dad column, but you don't have to wait till then because you can get reviews of a lot more toys and games at our website, parentsatplay.com. Hey, but don't go quite yet because there's a lot more of Positive Parenting coming up right ahead.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
This is Nnamdi Asamoah. I play football for the Philadelphia Eagles, but what I do off the field with United Way might be more important. I'm a volunteer tutor and mentor. Why? Because over a million kids a year drop out of school, and that's not okay. It takes 12 years to create a graduate, but it takes about the same time to create a dropout. And the difference between a child becoming one or the other could be me, or it could be you. Studies show that if we get to these kids earlier, their chances are better. And kids who read well by third grade are more likely to graduate. So join me in United Way. Suit up and take the pledge. Become a volunteer reader, tutor, or mentor. Because when a child succeeds, we all succeed. Give. Advocate. Volunteer. Live United. Take the pledge at unitedway.org. Brought to you by United Way, the Ad Council, and the National Football League.
Get ready for more positive parenting with Armin Brott from the MrDad.com radio network.
Hey there, welcome to the second part of today's positive parenting show. I'm Armin Brott. Entrepreneur Jesse Itzler will try almost anything. He brazenly pretended to be an established hip-hop artist to secure a meeting with a studio head, and it led to a record deal. He convinced a group of successful business executives to invest in an unprecedented business plan, and it turned into Marquee Jet. He sincerely offered to run a 100-mile race in Spanx, that's from the activewear company, to get the attention of the beautiful founder of the company, and he ended up marrying her. His life is about being bold and risky, and it's brought him plenty of rewards. So when Jesse felt himself drifting on autopilot, he hired a rather unconventional trainer to live with him for a month. An accomplished Navy SEAL who was widely considered to be the toughest man on the planet. In this part of today's show, we're going to be talking with Jesse about his experience. He is pretty much as easygoing as you can get. SEAL, however, is not. He even shows up at Jesse's apartment with an inflatable raft just in case the family ever has to escape Manhattan by crossing the Hudson River. Jesse and SEAL's escapades produce a great friendship, and by the time SEAL leaves, Jesse is in the best shape of his life. But he gains a lot more than muscle, and he learns perhaps one of the most important life lessons, which is the benefits of stepping out of your comfort zone. I'm Armin Brott. We'll meet Jesse Itzler when Positive Parenting continues right after this.
It's Practical Polly Radio. I've switched to cooking with healthier oils. So now what do I do with all these tubs of lard? Skinny jeans feeling too tight? A bit of lard on your hips and thighs and those pants slide on like a dream. So there's no need for that lard to go to waste. But get your best heart-healthy trade-up with healthier oils, like canola, olive, or other vegetable oils, which can actually lower your chances for heart disease. Learn more at heart.org/facethefats. Canola Info is the national supporter of the American Heart Association's Face the Fats campaign.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. My guest for this part of today's show is Jesse Itzler, who is the author of Living with a SEAL, 31 Days Training with the Toughest Man on the Planet. Jesse, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So how is it that you happen to meet a SEAL in the first place?
Well, I was running a 24-hour race in San Diego as part of a six-person relay team with five other friends, and we were each going to take a leg, a turn running a leg of this relay, and basically it was whatever team runs the most miles wins. And there was a guy sitting next to me at the starting line and sitting next to my group who didn't have a team, who was running the entire relay race for 24 hours alone. And he weighed about 270 pounds. He was just a really big muscular guy, which is a ton of weight to carry for that long of running. And by mile 70, he had broken all the bones in both the small bones in both of his feet and had kidney failure because of all the weight. And I literally watched this guy finish the last 30 miles on pure grit, focus, drive, determination, whatever you want to call it. And I was so inspired, so blown away that I literally just Googled him after the race. And I found out he was a Navy SEAL with an amazing backstory. And I cold called him. I flew out to meet him. And about 10 minutes into our conversation, I realized that if whatever this guy had, and I didn't know what it was at the time, rubbed off on me, that all the different buckets in my life would be so much better. And I literally just...
Yeah.
I literally just asked him to come live with me for a month, me and my family. And he said yes.
You see how much this thing has changed you, the fact that you can say that somebody had broken all the bones in his feet and kidney failure, and then you can say it within the same sentence, and he finished the last 30 miles.
30 miles.
I mean, the idea that you would finish the last 30 feet in that condition is enough. Yeah.
And no, what he did was he just literally would look about 15 yards ahead of him, and he would say, all right, let me just get to that tree. And then, okay, let me go look 20 yards past that. Let me get to that sign. And he did that for 30 miles and finished it. And, you know, at the time, it's interesting because at the time that he came into my life, I had a great life. I was married. I had an 18-month-old son. I'd sold a couple of businesses. And everything was great, and I was exercising. I was in a good place in my life, but I found myself in just a routine, and routines are great, but they can also be a rut, as we all know. And like so many of us, I was just caught up in this, you know, I was just drifting onto autopilot. I was on cruise control. I wasn't getting better, and I couldn't get out of it. And I'm a motivated guy, but I just, for some reason, at this point in my life, it was just hard for me to get past my comfort zone, and he was the right guy at the right time for me. And again, it impacted my parenting, it impacted my business, and impacted my relationship with my wife in a very positive way.
And it continues to impact it after all this time?
It does. I mean, you know, of course I have my moments like we all do, but you know, at 30,000 feet and you know, in the spirit of it lives on for sure.
So why do you identify him only as SEAL? Was that part of a deal that he didn't want his name used?
Well, you know, I kept the blog during our time together, and I just wanted to keep it consistent with the book. The blog was primarily about the training that we did. I got in great shape, but it was the what makes this guy tick and what can I learn from a guy like this that everybody was really interested. So when I decided to share that in the book, I just wanted to keep it consistent. But his name is David Goggins, and you know, he's been it's out there now. But I wanted to keep it consistent.
Yeah.
I also wanted people to have their own image of what this guy looked like without Googling him, or you know, I wanted them to have their own mental picture. Readers.
Sure. So he's a former SEAL, though, right?
He's a former SEAL.
I mean, he wasn't. Yeah, he wasn't on active, because you mentioned in the book at some point that he. Before he started SEAL training, he weighed, what did you say, 290 pounds and was able to trim down by more than 100 over the course of a couple months, because you can't be a SEAL and weigh 290 pounds.
Yeah, he was actually on active duty when he lived with me.
Oh, okay.
And he took his leave, his time that he had built up, or his leave time, to come stay with me. And yes, that's true. He lost all this weight. He had 60 days to report to BUDS, basic training, basically SEAL training, and he was about 200, or close to 300 pounds, and he lost all that weight. I don't know if that's a requirement, a legal requirement or whatever, but you know, he knew he wouldn't get through training at that weight, and he lost a tremendous amount of weight fast.
No, I think that, yeah, I'm not sure that it's a requirement. I actually did a lot of work with Navy SEALs. I've written a lot about fatherhood and so... did some work with some Navy SEAL dads, and they're just not, for those who don't know, I mean, you're already describing one, that they're not like real people. They're kind of like real people. I mean, you know, I don't want to say on steroids, because they're definitely not on steroids, but they're just they're like, you know, they're like superheroes. You know, they have, as far as, you know, from what I understood, they spend 7 or 8 hours a day training with Olympic trainers, and they have the best of every possible equipment, and then they go out and do horrible things and come back and bounce their kids on their knees. It's just how they can jockey all that stuff and juggle all of those roles at the same time and not just go off completely off the rails. I thought it was just a marvelous thing, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think, you know, you touched upon it, but we're all in our own way disciplined or try to be, but to be consistently disciplined is so hard. And as a parent, you know, that's also very difficult, right? To teach our kids to be the consistency, the repetition, as it relates to discipline is so important. And he was the most consistently disciplined human. And everything was about effort. And, you know, for him, you know, one of the key takeaways for me was about when he first moved in, the first thing that we did on our 31-day journey is he took me down to the gym. He wanted to see how many pull-ups I could do. And I did 8. And then he said, all right, wait 30 seconds and do it again. And I did like 6. And then he said, all right, wait 30 seconds and get up on the bar again. And I got maybe 3. And I was done. My arms killed. I was done. And he said, all right, we're not going to leave here until you do 100 more. And I looked at him, and I said, first of all, I don't barely know this guy. And I said, that's physically impossible. That's great, but I cannot, it's impossible for me to do that. And he immediately wanted to prove to me that my mind was dictating a lot of things that I was doing that I was wrong. And he said, I don't care how long it takes you to do it, but we're not leaving here until you do 100. So I ended up doing it. It took hours. And what he taught me was in that first 5 minutes of, you know, our journey together was that we all have this reserve tank. And, you know, our brain at the first whiff of pain or discomfort tells us to stop. But when we tap into that reserve tank, we're capable of so much more. And, you know, he had this rule, the 40% rule we call it, that when your brain tells you you're done, you're really only 40% done. And every day was about tapping into that reserve tank and digging in past that 40% and to see really what we're capable of. And not just physically, but even, you know, at work, putting in extra time, doing something you didn't want to do. It was all about getting uncomfortable, being comfortable being uncomfortable, getting out of your comfort zone, and realizing that to get better, again, I use mm-hmm. relationship, I use parenting, all of that. It's about getting uncomfortable. Tonight, I have 4 kids. They're all under 6 years old. And tonight was an uncomfortable night. You know, I love my family. I have a strong appreciation. I love I just love being a dad. But, you know, when you're up feeding at 2 in the morning and kids are going wild and, you know, it's difficult, and you have to, sometimes you got to dig into that reserve tank. You got to say, you know what, it's okay. You got more in you. You can do this and get through it. So, you know, it was a great journey. And for me, it started out, I wanted to get in great shape, but then I had all these life lessons that came along with it.
Talking with Jesse Itzler, who's the author of Living with a SEAL, 31 Days Training with the Toughest Man on the Planet. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will keep on talking to Jesse about living with a SEAL and life changes and family and a lot more. I'm Armin Brandt. You're listening to Positive Parenting.
When I have an asthma attack, I feel scared.
It's like tiny nails in the air poke my lungs.
I start to cough.
Sometimes my parents have to take me to the hospital.
Today, 1 out of 13 children suffer from some form of asthma, accounting for nearly one-third of all emergency room visits.
I feel like I'm choking.
It's kind of like an elephant is on my chest.
A little whistle sound comes out when I breathe.
But while your child may suffer from asthma, asthma doesn't have to make your child suffer. There are simple ways you can prevent your child's next attack. To learn more, call 1-866-NO-ATTACKS. That's 1-866-662-8822. Log on to www.noattacks.org or call your doctor. Because even one attack is one too many.
I feel like a fish with no water.
Brought to you by the EPA, the Ad Council, and this station.
We'll be right back. Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Broad. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Jesse Itzler, who's the author of Living with a SEAL, 31 Days Training with the Toughest Man on the Planet. So, Jesse, where were you then if you were able to barely drag yourself on day one through 100 pull-ups? I don't want to say barely because that was spread out over time. But, you know, being able to do eight and then, so where were you on day 31?
Well, you know, when he first came, I could do 22 push-ups. And when he left, I was doing 1,000 a day. And I had knocked off, I'm a runner, and I had knocked off, well, I was a jogger, and I became a runner, but I knocked about a minute off of my mile pace, which is incredible. So I had these really unbelievable gains. And and I would say that, you know, honestly, a lot of that was through mental adjustments. I mean, the physical came with it, but you can't get those kind of gains physically in a month without having really a real different approach mentally. And I just started approaching things with a completely different attitude. And you know, it's also, I had the benefit of, it's one thing to read about inspiration, and you've done a lot of time with SEALs and spend time. It's a completely different thing to live with it.
Oh, I can't imagine.
Right, and when you're around someone that's, you know, just done so much. I mean, this guy's backstory is absolutely incredible. He broke the Guinness Book of World Records for the most pull-ups. He failed. He did 4,030 in 17 hours, and he had failed two times in his attempts, the first two attempts to break the record. And in the course of trying to break the record, he did 67,000 pull-ups during his preparation and training. 67,000.
That's enough for a couple lifetimes, yeah.
It goes back to the discipline, the consistency, the will, the ability to go beyond, the benefit of getting uncomfortable. And as that kept getting reinforced and he kept kicking me out of my comfort zone and through all kinds of different things that are in the book, all of a sudden, all this amazing potential was realized.
So I want to talk to you a little bit about, or have you talked to us any, a little bit about how this affected your family? Because, you know, you're living with a guy, but they're there too, right?
Right. So at the time, I had one child. I had a son who was 18 months. He loved it because he felt he had a real live Power Ranger in our house. So, you know, for him and his friends, they thought that, Jesse's got a gladiator living with them. For my wife, my wife's an entrepreneur. She's always kind of lived her life putting herself out there and trying different things and not being scared of unusual situations. So she welcomed the opportunity. I think she was a little freaked out at first. But, you know, we came from two different worlds. He's an African-American guy from Brazil, Indiana, with a wild, tough childhood. I grew up in Long Island, you know, from a working-class family, but just a completely different atmosphere, loving parents, still married 60 plus years. He came from a broken family, saw his dad get murdered in front of him. So when these two worlds clashed, it was just, I think my wife really embraced the opportunity to learn and appreciate what we had, but also want a little bit of what he had, which was simplicity. You know, he was in complete control of his time and what he wanted to do. He was able to eliminate, and some of this rubbed off on me, started taking way more control of my own time by eliminating like non-essential meetings, business meetings, lunches that I felt obligated. I didn't want to hurt someone's feelings, so I would take a lunch that really wasn't going to move the needle in my life. And all of a sudden, my time started getting, I wasn't in control of it. It was being completely dominated by other people. So a little of that simplicity started to rub off on me and my wife. So, again, you know, two worlds clashing, you start to pick up traits and characteristics that are different because you're exposed to it sort of for the first time.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah. Do you find yourself incorporating some of these lessons? I mean, obviously you're not going to have your kids doing thousands of pull-ups, but pushing them a little bit further in a maybe a sports context or maybe not even a sports context, to be able to just do an extra couple of math problems or whatever it is. You find that, that idea of getting out of your comfort zone, pushing yourself beyond where you think you can go, that's something you've incorporated into your parenting?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's so hard. You know, just parenting is so hard in general, and I struggle with that balance between pushing too hard and, you know, I have to let my children live their lives and not the life that I want them to lead. But, you know, I think that every kid should have to run a marathon before they're, or at least try, before they're 18. I think it teaches them the importance of setting a goal. It teaches them about breaking down a big task into a lot of smaller tasks, 26 miles into 1 mile at a time. It teaches them about preparation. It teaches them about hard work and reward or failure. And that failure isn't about necessarily not finishing, crossing the finish line. It's more about not preparing, not having that consistency and that discipline or even trying. So I think that's in a really that's a really important thing to me. Now, my oldest is 6, so I don't think he's going to want to hear that in a couple of years when we start talking about that, but I think that's a really important thing. And it doesn't have to be a marathon. Maybe it's a half marathon, but I really think having a big, lofty challenge at an early age is a really important thing. So that's something that I'm going to try to do. But, you know, it's hard because I like to run every day. I've set up a routine that works for me, and I don't really deviate from that routine. And the routine has to do with what I eat, how working out, going to work, the relationship with my wife, how I raise my kids. I mean, it's all part of me and my day-to-day life. It's my lifestyle. But I can't, you know, I have to walk that fine line on how I ease my children into that kind of balance, and because all four of my kids are so different, and they all have, my approach with all of them is completely different because their personalities are different, their drive is different, their abilities are different. So that's been a hard, you know, finding that balance for me has been really, really challenging.
Yeah. No, I can't. I'm just trying to imagine how I would incorporate that into my life. I think it's a great idea to have a goal of doing a marathon or some sort of a big physically challenging event. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it think about what goes into a marathon. It's a tremendous amount of preparation. It's a tremendous amount of researching and learning and trying and getting to know yourself in time. You know, and again, taking this big, big challenge, and which we all, you know, so many in life, we've all been overwhelmed with something like, oh, this is too big, I can't do it, it's too big a task, it's too big a, but once you break it down into even your to-do list,
yeah,
you start to attack it one item at a time, that 50 item to-do list becomes, that was overwhelming yesterday, becomes doable today because we're going one at a time, 1 mile at a time, one step at a time,
yeah.
one you know, one training session at a time.
So is this a once-in-a-lifetime kind of a thing, or would you consider doing it again?
Well, this has set me up for, I was so inspired by this. I got so many life lessons, valuable nuggets from this, that I'm going to do a series of books where I live with interesting people. So I'm going to live with a monk next. I'm going to keep doing it until my wife says we can't have more strangers in our house.
Enough with you and the house guests already.
Yeah. Exactly.
Go get yourself an apartment. Yeah.
Exactly.
So a monk, so that would be a totally different thing. So you're not going to be doing push-ups with the monk. So this is going to be like a 24-hour or 31-day silent meditation kind of a thing or something?
It'll be something along those lines, yeah.
Wow. And did your wife have any interest in joining you for any of this stuff, or was she just sort of sitting there shaking her head the whole time?
I think she likes watching the movie better than being in the movie.
Makes some sense, I guess. Yeah. Okay.
She likes watching the movie, but you know, she doesn't really want to participate in the movie right now.
Jesse Itzler is the author of Living with a Seal, 31 Days Training with the Toughest Man on the Planet, and Twitter is @the100mileman, just so people know that you were already doing kind of remarkable things before you met the SEAL. Jesse, thanks for joining us.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Positive Parenting. You can get more information on today's show and what we're working on in the weeks ahead at MrDad.com. While you're there, visit the MrDad.com gift shop with everything you need to help you become the dad or mom you want to be. Positive Parenting is a production of the MrDad.com radio network. Now, go be a great parent.